We're going to continue our study this morning in the book of Genesis. We'll be in chapter 35. Remember that as we studied together last week, there was a sad chapter in the life of Jacob's family, in which the male inhabitants in particular of the town of Shechem were murdered. And God was not pleased with that. Now, on the heels of that, as we get into chapter 35, let's remember that even though most of that family was probably killed, there are ramifications and consequences for things like that. Other people in the area, even if it's different families, might look upon, and certainly would look upon Jacob's family as perhaps troublemakers and some people to be dealt with. So let's keep that in mind as we get into chapter 35, and it will bring into light why God calls him to do what he calls him to do. I'm going to read down through a few verses here, starting in verse 1. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel, and live there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods which are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone." God realizes the situation there too, probably comes to Jacob and says, you know, it's time to move. It's time to let things kind of calm down in this area here. So he tells him he wants him to go to Bethel. Now, Bethel is one of those places that he was familiar with. His family was very familiar with. Bethel comes up over and over again in our study here. So he would be probably comforted to be able to go there. But in verse 2 here, it says that he says to his household to put away the foreign gods which are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Now, who do we know in particular in his household, we're certain of, that has foreign gods?
Rachel.
Rachel has taken those from her father Laban's tent and brought them all this journey right here. And you might think to yourself, well, that's who he's honing in on. But Jacob doesn't know that she has this. Where else might these foreign gods or these idols have come from? Well, they've just destroyed a city. What did they take in the spoils and the plunder of the city of ungodly people? The foreign. And these things probably would have been made of gold and silver in particular. And so they would have had what we might call street value to them there. So they would have been something they would have held on to, if only to sell in the future, if they had the chance to do that, for the value of what they were worth that way. But they're still idols. They're still things that can draw them away from God, Lord Jehovah. And so he says to them, I want whatever you've collected that way, wherever it's come from. Because we're gonna purge ourselves here. We're gonna cleanse ourselves before we make this move. God's come to me and he wants us to go there. I want to make sure that when we get there, God will continue to bless the family. And so it's a smart move on his part to do this. It says in verse 3, I'll make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. Now, this is another one of those verses that kind of cement the idea in my mind anyway that he's growing in this relationship with God. That over and over again, as he needs God, and who doesn't need God each and every day of our life, but in particular in his situation where there's been one drama after another in his life, God has been there. God has not only been there, God has directed him. Now, in our life, I'd like to make an application here. In our life, we have exactly the same kind of relationship that we're called to with God. But in his life, God actually comes to him, whether it be in a vision or something else, comes to him and actually says, "This is what I want you to do." God speaks with him. Now for us, like I say, God calls us to exactly the same relationship, but God doesn't speak to us that way. How then do we make sure that we are in that kind of associative relationship with God to make sure that he's going to bless us? Well, obviously, we have to be in his word. We have to be in his word to do that. We have to over and over and over again go to his word to make sure that we are in that kind of relationship, we remain in that relationship, and we grow in that relationship. And really, if there's any, it's not even a secret, if there's any application to it, that's the application. We're supposed to constantly be growing in this relationship with God, not stagnating in the relationship. God calls us to that growth, not only for ourselves, but for our family members that are among us too. If I'm growing as a grandpa to my children, hopefully I am, I'm expected to show as an example to them so they also can grow towards God or in God that way. For every one of us, the application is as clear as can be. We have to be in His Word. We have to constantly be in His Word. The beautiful thing about the relationship, I've talked about this over and over again, the beautiful thing about the relationship that God calls us to is that we're not alone in it. We're not alone. Later in this chapter, we're going to see one verse in particular of an individual that probably feels a lot of ways alone and the consequence of what happens because of that. But for us, God doesn't tell you, I'm going to put you on this journey by yourself. He calls us to a journey in which each one of us, in essence, are spiritually holding each other's hand in this thing, encouraging each other along. The design of the church is the most remarkable design that I can ever think of in the world. You know, I think about this a lot because I've benefited from it a lot. And sometimes I wonder, I scratch my head and go, God, why do you care for me so much? I'm not that good. I'm not that, you know, I'm not worth it. And yet, when I see how much of a design in the church He has for me, I see I'm encouraged by each and every one of you. I'm encouraged by you being here this morning, for that matter, each one of you. But He calls us to this design because it's going to benefit us. Jacob, I think, is getting it. Jacob's getting it. Verse 4, so they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had and the rings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem. By the way, sometimes we wonder where earrings came from originally. I mean, biblically speaking, or in the history and the culture of the Bible, we find that earrings were actually amulets. They were worn to signify which god you served, in other words. And I know that's probably lost in history somewhere along the line, but that's kind of the biblical way of looking at earrings there. So when it says they took these rings or these earrings and they gave them to him, they're basically saying, okay, those are part of the idol worship. They hand them to him. He hides them. Leaves them there. Basically, that's the way we look at it. He leaves them there as if they're worthless. And by the way, they are. And they journey on. As they journeyed, in verse 5 here, there was a great terror upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. It doesn't really elaborate on what this great terror is, but what's happening here? That's come ahead of them for sure. So they're thinking about that too. But it's also God's way of protecting them as they come along here too. God's going to take care of Jacob and his families here. But that's a very good point. There's not the newspapers, there's not the internet or anything, but there's certainly word of mouth is going on. And something like that doesn't stay hidden. I mean, that's going to be a big story in the area. Yeah, that's right. And we see that later on too in the children of Israel coming back from the Exodus, that before they even enter into the land of Canaan, what is already known about them? Well, the Red Sea parting and in any of these other battles that were going along here, they're a force to be reckoned with. I mean, to be feared. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, it comes ahead of time there. It's not like these people are ignorant of who Jacob and his family is here. Verse 6, so Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, and he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him. when he fled from his brother. Now, El Bethel could be basically interpreted as the house of God or the place of God there, because God had come to him there. Now, Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the oak. It was named Allon Bacuth. This is an odd verse in the middle of all this that's going on here. A lot of people would think, well, because it's inserted here, somehow Deborah was with his family. That's not what it's saying here. It's just saying as they come to Bethel, it happens to be right here that Deborah had passed away and been buried here. Who's Deborah, by the way? That's a future Deborah. That's not there yet. But you're right. You're right. There's a couple of Deborahs in the Bible. Which Deborah is this here? Well, it says right there, Rebecca's nurse, so it helps us out a little bit right there. The reason this verse is interesting as much as anything to me is she must have had a positive effect on the family, generally speaking. Now, where did she come from? She came from the original place Rebecca came from. She came with Rebecca. It was part of the package that came along. So she basically was from that area, which would have made her somewhat Syrian in heritage. And so apparently she has had, she's been somebody that's been admired because it's recorded here. The other part of this, and I had mentioned this a while back in our study, what about Rebecca? We don't have any recording of Rebecca passing. We have a recording of her nurse passing away, but what about Rebecca? Well, Rebecca is one of those kind of lost characters, and there may be a reason for that. Rebecca had not acted in the best interest of the family by her influencing Jacob the way that she did. And we do read later on in chapter 59 that she did die. I mean, that's in the future that they're looking back to the past when they name a few people that died and were buried basically in the same place. She's mentioned at that time. But she's not mentioned in the fact that she actually passed away or that she was mourned or that people came to the funeral or any of that kind of stuff in there. It's kind of glaring that way to me. But that's just the way. And yet Deborah is mentioned here. Then God appeared to Jacob again in verse 9 when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." And he thus called him Israel. God also said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. And the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you. And I will give the land to your descendants after you." Now this is just a reiteration of the promise basically made to Abraham, made to Isaac, carried on through to Jacob here. So again, God is basically telling him, "I'm with you. I'm reaffirming the relationship I have you. I'm reaffirming the covenant that was made with Abraham, your grandfather, and we're just going to continue on with this." It's interesting that he says, "And kings shall come forth from you." What was the setup for the governing agency of the family at the time? We call this the patriarchal time. We don't see that Abraham was called a king. We don't see that Isaac was called a king. They weren't. And yet somewhere in the future, there's going to be kings. This is a prophecy. A prophecy that, of course, does come through from the lineage of one of his sons in particular, which was David. First king coming out of the tribe of Benjamin. Through Judah. I apologize. Through Judah. But the first king came through the tribe of Benjamin. That would be Saul. Foretelling of kings coming about. And again, sometimes I read these things and I wonder just how much Jacob could really perceive what God's talking to him about here. There's times that God will reaffirm the relationship or reaffirm the covenant, and I don't necessarily think the individual completely understands the fullness of what's happening with that. Did Abraham, for instance, understand the fullness that all nations of the earth will be blessed through your seed? Now, I don't think he could possibly have understood that. But God says these things for us to understand. God says these things for us to have evidence of his existence, evidence of his taking care of people, evidence of the prophecy coming true, so we can put trust in God that way. It's interesting that when you're talking to people nowadays, a lot of times somebody might believe in God, but if you ask them why they believe in God, or you ask them what's the evidence for that, they can't really give you a strong, conclusive evidence as to why. Well, you know, we live in a Christian nation, so I'm a Christian. Well, God has given us so much more than that. And God expects us to flesh that out. And to in order to build our faith in God, we have to pursue it. We actually have to pursue that knowledge. And sometimes I think people stop at a particular place and they're just happy with where they are at that. It's almost like somebody saying, well, if I can just get into heaven, I'll be happy to be in heaven. And there's some truth to that. Of course there's truth to that. But it's like we come to the table of feast and we're happy to have the bread crumbs instead of sitting at the table with the king. Well, I'm just happy to have a few bread crumbs that fall on the ground. And I have to scratch my head at that. Why? Why are we satisfied with so little when there's so much that God offers us? So much he has for us. So many blessings he has in store for us. And we'll just be satisfied to kind of hang around with the blessed people instead, as if that's going to be enough. For each one of us, I think we should thirst for that water, the water that Christ has for us, and a water that's not going to cause us to be thirsty again that way. God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him in verse 13. Apparently, what that would mean is that there was some kind of physical evidence of God actually standing before him there. Now, whether that was, again, God made manifest in a human form for the time being, because there's something in which that form is lifted up, goes up to heaven from there. So, For Jacob, and I'd love to be there, for Jacob, it's like, this is the witness of God speaking to me and physically going up to heaven from that point. There's the confirmation over and over and over again as this man grows in his faith in God. Jacob set up a pillar in verse 14 in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured out a libation on it. And he also poured oil on it. So Jacob named the place where God had spoken with him Bethel. And of course, Bethel, as I pointed out, means house of God. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. It came about when she was in severe labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for now you have another son." It came about as her soul was departing, for she died, that she named him Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. A sad case of her passing on at this time. She wanted so desperately, and we've looked at this in our relationship study, she wanted so desperately to have a child. And God finally allowed that to happen, and she had Joseph, and she was overjoyed that she had Joseph. She most likely, because of the type of woman she was, desperately wanted another child. And God allowed that to happen too, but unfortunately she died in the childbirth of Benjamin here. She says that Rachel named him Benoni, and that means son of my sorrow. And it's probably in connection with the fact that the labor was so intense and so painful for her there. And you have to believe that she she may have felt that she was passing away, that she was dying. And she was not going to be able to live to see this young child be raised. And that would be very sorrowful for her. But Jacob takes it upon himself to rename him because he doesn't want to remember this situation as being this incredibly negative thing for Rachel's sake here. So he renames him, which means Benjamin, which means the son of the right hand, which means it's very, very important to him. That this is one of my preeminent sons here, along with Joseph, is who this young man is going to be. Now, Benjamin, of course, is truly the baby of the family. Then there won't be any more children born after this. So Benjamin's going to be certainly a favorite of him, of Jacob's, and we will see that play in later on in our study. Jacob set up a pillar in verse 20 over her grave, that is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Then Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Eder. And it came about while Israel was dwelling in that land that Reuben went out and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard of it. Now there were 12 sons of Jacob, which obviously belongs with the next verse there. I want to touch on this just for a moment because this is truly a relationship study. We have to talk about relationship. This is one little verse with great consequence to it here. Bilhah was first of all, the maid of Rachel. Now Rachel has passed on. Bilhah's standing in the family doesn't necessarily change because of that, but her mistress is gone now. I made the point, I think, a couple of lessons ago that Bilhah and Zilpah were probably not, these are the two handmaids that were given as lesser wives, concubines, were probably not in any kind or virtually any kind of relationship with Jacob. They were given for one particular purpose to him. That was to have children through them. The children would therefore be in name the mistress's children, Leah and Rachel. It would be easy, I think, to assume that because both of these women are truly women, human beings, their desires in life were probably to have a man of their own, to have a family of their own, to find self-esteem in that. And to some degree, they probably did find some self-esteem in having these sons that they did. And they belong to a predominant family here. This is a well-to-do family. And I'm not saying they weren't taken care of. But human beings are human beings. I don't care what the scale is for where you think you are on a scale here. Human beings have human feelings. And for these two women, they were not in the perfect situation that they probably would have hoped for in their life at some point. Now, yes, they were servants, so they and this is a class system at that time. So they were probably as better off as they possibly could be in the class system that they're in. But there's still feelings that go on. Now, I'm not in any way trying to make excuses for what happened here because this is not a situation that God would look at and say, this is fine. Not at all. But Reuben has grown. Reuben is the oldest, of course, and he's grown to be a young man. He's at least in his 20s by this time. And he makes an overture towards Bilhah, who is his, I don't know if I even use the term stepmom, because that's not the way it was set up at all there. She's a stranger to him, I mean, virtually, in that respect. But she probably has longed for attention from a husband that she doesn't have at all. And so I guess what I'm saying is she might be easy prey in that matter, wanting to have some kind of affection, wanting to have some kind of connection to this family still, wanting to feel important, some kind of esteem in this family. But what happens here is something that later on, I'm not going to get into it right now, but later on, the consequences down the road because of what happens here as well. And it's injected here because Israel hears of it, but it doesn't say anything about what he does at that time about it. You have to understand, for Jacob, this is, in his mind, this is not Rachel. This is not even Leah in his mind right here. This is somebody that happens to be in the family that he's had a child with, but he has no real connection with. I mean, it's just not there for him. And yet it's still something that would be a black eye to him and to the family for what would happen here. But he doesn't deal with it in any way that we see at this time. Now, I don't know if it's just not written down here, but that's all we have. It says there were 12 sons of Jacob. The sons of Leah were Reuben. I'm just going over the list here again. Let's refresh ourselves. Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, then Simeon and Levi and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel are Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, were Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maid, were Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. And Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre of Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, which Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Well, it was good, certainly, that Jacob was able to find his way back home before his father passed away. But there's something else here that is even better, that he and his brother were able to rebuild their relationship so that the two of them could come together to bury their father together in the way that they were supposed to be able to do that. We even saw, of course, that when Abraham died, Ishmael and Isaac came together to bury him. Now, I'm not saying there were any hard feelings between Ishmael and Isaac. There were probably some things that were going on, but this is a time where the family comes together to do something of honor, something of respect for them. You know, I'd like to say that in our modern age, that's exactly what happens when we come together for a funeral of one of our deceased parents, that even if you have trouble with your siblings before, you put those to the side and you come together and you act like good people to do this very good thing together. That's not what always happens, though, of course, because, again, people are people. But he lived to be 180 years old, and he passes away. Any comments or questions or anything before we move to the next chapter? Don't see anything. Okay. We're actually going to not read through chapter 36, not for the purpose of the study we're doing in relationship. I would urge you to go ahead and read it. There are a few interesting things. It's mostly just information on Esau's family and what happens with Esau's family and the generations that come out of Esau's family. Sometimes I refer back to this chapter later on, because there are particular people that come out of that family that we want to understand. Why are these people even involved in Israel's family? But they are cousins, so it's good to refer back to it. We're going to get in chapter 37 then, the next 10 minutes or so. Joseph's dream. Now Jacob lived in the land where his brother had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. We know, because, of course, we've read ahead quite a bit, that there's conflict going on in this family. And what is the conflict between Joseph and his brothers? I mean, basically. Favoritism. Apparent. I mean, blatant favoritism. And it says here that he's coming out and he's meeting with his brothers here, kind of checking the situation out, probably sent out from his father to do that. And he brings back a bad report. Now, it doesn't say what the report is. It just says it's not a favorable report about what the brothers are up to out there. Joseph's probably thinking that they should be doing something else than what they're doing out here. We don't know what that is. But in verse 3, we see now Israel loved Jacob, Joseph, more than all of his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a varied colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. There's a lot of damage that's going on here. He makes him this coat, this tunic, this outer garment. And apparently, and I'm sure you know this already, but apparently this would have been a very expensive garment to make. Anything when you get into a variety of colors, the weaving patterns and so forth, I'm not a weaver, I don't know much about it that way, but I understand that it would be more time consuming, especially in those days, to do this kind of thing. And some of these colors in particular were very expensive to do, very expensive to do. And so it's kind of this, the other brothers already know that there's favoritism going on. But as he's wearing this coat, it's like a flag of favoritism that's going on as well. Everywhere he comes, everywhere they see him, they got to be right. Oh yeah, yeah, he's daddy's favorite there. So they're not very pleased with him to begin with, to the point that it says they couldn't speak to him on friendly terms. Now that in itself is really sad if you think about it. Can you imagine yourself being in a family where perhaps you were the one trying to do as good as you possibly could, but you have brothers and sisters, maybe 6 or 7 brothers and sisters, and there's not one of them that's going to speak to you on friendly terms day in and day out? Is that going to wear on you as well that way? Of course it is. And the problem is, when we don't face those kind of things in our lives, when we don't face that friction in our life, does it go away? No, it actually just builds greater and greater all the time, to where there's hard feelings all the way around on everything. And that's what's happening here with him. Then Joseph, in verse 5 here, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. All right. And he said to them, of course, he had to tell them what the dream was, obviously. Yes. There's no indication to me exactly why, apart from the fact that he knows Joseph's heart above all the other ones. And I mean above it in that he's trying to remain righteous to God. He was the perfect servant to do that task, that particular task. Now be careful. Some in this class here today are probably younger ones. I'm not, but yeah. But I see over and over again in the Bible people chosen for tasks because God knows their heart. Why was David chosen out of all of his brothers? He was the youngest one. He was not the one that anybody would have chosen. But God knew his heart. God knew what he was capable of doing. God knew what he had to work with this particular person. Sometimes in our life, you just scratch your head about decisions that people make. Let's say, and I'm talking about perhaps spiritual decisions. And then you come to realize later on, they were the perfect one for that. And they became a missionary or something. You're thinking to yourself, this is the young man I had nothing but trouble with in class. And I'm gonna write this one off. No, I don't do that, by the way. I've never done that. But there's times you just kind of shake your head, Philip. Yeah. And that, yes. But I think what we're gonna see too, and I know this is down the road, but I've been through the study and I know what I want to get to. I think what we're going to see with Joseph in particular is this is a remarkable young man. This is a absolutely remarkable young man who is hurt severely by what happens here. And He needs closure later on. You think to yourself, oh, no, he didn't, you know. No, he seriously needs closure later on for the whole family to move forward. And so what I'm saying is he's a human being. Even though we might say, oh, well, he just never faltered. No, this young man was scarred by what happened here. And we find out later on the emotional scarring of him can only be healed by closure with his brothers. And it happens. That's the beautiful part about it. You might have something there. We don't know in the long run because, of course, what happens along the way is he believes Joseph is dead at some point completely. And at that point, that affection, the fullness of that affection has to pass on to who? Benjamin. Has to. And we see that play out later on. But Benjamin is so young that these other older brothers don't... Well, I'm getting way ahead of myself on this because there's so much that goes on. And I've got to say, it's not just the growth of Joseph that we see as he grows into being 40, 50 years old. It's the growth of the brothers that we see too. A lot of times we dismiss them as just being a bunch of hooligans. I mean, good grief, how can you do this and how can you do that? But there's growth in these men too. And I don't want to leave the study and say, well, you know, they just muddled along in their life because they grow. And it's a beautiful part of the study. It's amazing, but Joseph was the one that could years later stand before his brothers as closure comes and say, I now know why God did this. Do you think he knew why God did it when he was in Potiphar's house? No. He didn't even know it when he's put second in command. He doesn't know why God allowed this to happen or why this happened in his family. It's not until that closure comes that he can stand before his brothers and honestly say to them, I now know why God did this, why God has done this. I now know. And what he's saying is, I now know why God has allowed me to serve him this way, is what he's telling them. And I mean, we're light years away from that at this point right here, because all we're at right now is a 17-year-old kid who's telling his brothers, and by the way, at 17 years old in the Bible days, who pays attention to you? Nobody. Nobody. You know? Except his doting father, perhaps. But beyond that, he has no credibility with his brothers. In fact, he really has no credibility with them because they hate him. Yeah. Then and that wall of hatred is creating an animosity that cannot be stopped. I mean, in the right way at this time. Not in their minds anyway. And that's what's so sad about it, because that kind of hatred, that kind of an animosity, that kind of wall that we put up in our relationships does so much damage in our lives. It does so much damage in the peripheral people around our lives because we get everybody involved in it. If I'm putting that kind of wall up between myself and a brother in Christ, I'm teaching my children to do that. I'm showing my grandchildren this is an acceptable way to act. It's not. It's not, because there's only destruction on the other side of that. And that's why God calls us. He calls us to love our enemies. If you think about that, we'll close with this thought. If you think about God calling us to love our enemies, if he's called me to pray for and love my enemies, how much easier should it be for me to love my brothers and sisters in Christ? It should be so easy to build those relationships and keep them going strong. If he calls me to love my enemies... That's why God calls me to love my enemies. Wayne. And even at the very end, his closest followers also rejected him and fled, walked away. You're right. There's many similarities. In essence, Joseph is a type of Christ. And we'll see this play out as we go through our study with Joseph. This is just the beginning of it right here. And I'll have to tell you, I'm biased. Joseph is one of my favorite characters in all the Bible. All the Bible. There is so much in the study coming up with this young man that each one of us can't help but learn from on this in our relationship with God. We're out of time today. Again, thank you everybody for your comments and being here this morning.